Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Fox Football Podcast. We're recording this as well as the Vision, which has made me wear a collared shirt today. It means there's a very special guest, a very, very special guest, not the usual T-shirt. It's, yeah, this is about as formal as it gets. James Johnson, CEO of the FFA. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks, Adam, and very happy to be here with you.
No worries. I knew you'd come in a suit because you're a very important job. So, yeah, that's why I've dressed up, mate. So much to talk about, so much to take in at the moment. You're new to the role, only months in. What have you taken in so far? What have you noticed about Australian football?
So I've been in the job now for a month and a half, and the first 6 or 7 weeks it's really been about listening, Adam. It's been about listening to my staff within FFA. It's been about listening to the board that I report to. It's been listening to the stakeholders, the member federations, the clubs, both A-League and NPL, the players through the PFA, but also more broadly, it's been about listening to the football community, the players and the fans. And really what I've been trying to do is assess what the real challenges for the sport are. I've, of course, come in with my own ideas, but those ideas needed to be tested and developed based on what our football community are thinking. I think the main point, and I've stressed this before, but it really is about bringing the sport back together. I think it's no secret that the sport has been, for lack of a better word, at war the past 2 or 3 years. And certainly the feedback that I'm getting, the constant theme, is the need to really align stakeholders, align the community, so that we can move forward as a football community.
Has it helped with the knowledge that you have? I mean, you once upon a time played up there in Queensland. We'll get to John Cosmina a bit later on. I can't wait for some stories in that regard. But you played, so you knew the landscape to a certain degree there. You've gone overseas. You know how football works. You've worked inside FIFA, so you know exactly how it works on a global scale. But coming back to it, have you noticed how unique it is here? Do we just say that for the sake of saying it, in terms of the amount of stakeholders that are within the one sport here in Australia?
Yeah, I think it's I think any football country that you work in, there are elements that are common amongst, say, the 211 football countries of the world, but there are also specific issues that relate to specific countries. I think with Australia, a lot of the stakeholder tension, so the tension between a club and a players' union, or the tension between a league and the federations, these are quite normal. I think something that is specific to our code here is this sort of era tension that exists. And I think this is a challenge, but I think it's also an opportunity where we can try to unite the past with the present, and so we can move forward together into the future.
Obviously going to ask about key challenges, key opportunities. Glass half full kind of guy, so I'll ask about the opportunities first.
Okay.
What are the things that stand out to you about this game in Australia, which is a massive chance given the strength that lies within that particular aspect of football in Australia?
I think one of the opportunities is really transforming the organisation into one that is local. So we're based locally, but one that can actually operate in a global system. So if we look at some of the top sporting organisations, the top football organisations around the world, whether it's Juventus — we were speaking about Juventus before we did the podcast — or you look at the Japanese Football Association, US Soccer, or UEFA, what they've managed to do, I think, over the past decade is really take advantage of this globalisation of the sport and position themselves as a global player. If we think about what that means in an Australian context, we have a long line of history. I think we need to remember who we are, what our purpose is, where we started as a football community, and where we started was two clubs playing against each other, I think in about 1880. And obviously the clubs had players, and there were fans that watched a football match. And then it was from this match that the New South Wales Federation and the Football Victoria Federation and Queensland Federation, and then obviously the Australian Federation, which is now FFA, grew out of. So to me, it's about reconnecting with those stakeholders, with the players, with the clubs, with our member federations, and with the broader football community, remembering who we are locally. I think this is important for us to start at this point. But then we need to remember that it's not 1880 anymore, it's 2020. And the landscape looks a lot different in 2020 than it did back then. In fact, it looks a lot different today than what it did 10 years ago. I think if you look at that global space, we're seeing, for example, more players move across borders every year internationally. But if you look at the trends in Australia, we're probably actually seeing a decline in the number of Australians that are moving across borders every year. If you look at the international transfer market, which is about upwards of $10 billion, we're generating less than 2 million of that. So I think the challenge, but also the opportunity, is how do we remember who we are locally, but how do we hardwire ourselves in and take advantages of this global football industry, which I don't think we've taken advantage of in the past.
It sounds like the biggest challenge then in that respect is dealing with the romantic side of the game. And the nature of just loving the game as opposed to the hard, cold reality of, I don't know what you think, but it seems like football has never been more about money than ever before. So balancing those two and coming up with the right answer, is that your gig or is it everyone collectively that has to get their head around the fact that how do we mix those two?
Yeah, that's a loaded question.
Yeah.
I'll try and break it down.
Big style.
look, the commercial side is certainly important. You know, the more funding you have, the more we can invest in development, the more we can develop players and coaches, the better players we have, which ultimately improve our football products. I'm a big believer in putting football first and ensuring that our football products, whether it's our A-League or our FFA Cup, the NPL competition, or if we establish a new second tier level competition, really building these products and doing it in the right way. And I think if we can optimize our football products, I think the commercial revenues will come in.
How do you do that now, though, in your role, given the fact that the A-League clubs and by proxy the W-League sides as well are going off in their own direction or in another direction? Or is it parallel to what you're trying to do? How do you sum that up?
So this is also an immediate challenge. It's a focus of the organisation. The league is becoming what I would call unbundled from the federation. And this is quite a normal process. If you look at how leagues have developed all over the world, the Bundesliga or the J-League, for example, they've all started as effectively departments within the federation. And as they've grown, they've become less dependent on the federation. We're at that stage, and I see that as a good thing. I see it as a good thing because it means that we're becoming more sophisticated as a football nation. We're working through that process. So right now, the league is actually operating as its own business unit within FFA. And as the months go on, we'll be able to put a more concrete framework around that relationship. But I think where we've got to get to, the space we need to arrive at in the end is a relationship between the governing body and the league where both businesses, if you like, both associations, both organisations understand that the way that each other grow will be if we can actually work together and are aligned. And that's why I mentioned the Bundesliga and the J-League, because the relationships with the federations are both very good. And I think if you look at the strength of the league and the national teams, they're both actually doing very well.
That was my next question about what are the countries in your regard that have got it right, and does that relate to here, or are we unique in a sense?
I think every country has its own specificities. I personally like the German and the Japanese model much more than the Premier League model for Australia's purposes. And the reason is they've developed differently. So if you look at the English market, the Football League actually split from the Football Association in the mid to late 19th century. All right, that's when the league split. So. And that was soon after the FA was actually formed. And then if you fast forward to the early 90s, that's when the Premier League split from the Football League. So you've actually got parallel systems that have developed over hundreds of years. And that, of course, is not our story. I think our story is closer to a Germany or a Japan, where the federation has run the league, and then over time the league has become less dependent of the federation, and the federation has become more of a government that creates the environment for the league, which is like the private sector, to grow and develop. So for me, the German and the Japanese models are far more relevant based on where we are than, say, the Premier League model.
So inside that environment, I've written before about the fact that I don't believe it counts for much that we're the biggest sport in Australia in terms of participation. I've been into the FFA headquarters, and there's a big thing, and they're proud of it, and fair enough too, that how many people we've got playing and how good's that and this, that and the other. But my point of view is, why be the biggest if you can't be the best?
Mm-hmm.
It's like McDonald's. It's like biggest, most known brand going around. Is it the best food? Well, okay, McFlurry at 10 p.m. at night, or a cup of hash browns with a hangover, that's pretty good. But in terms of being the best, it's not quite right up there with your Michelin hatted restaurants. So where do you see that balance? Do you want more out of what we've got, or do you just want to have more people playing?
I personally think we need to look at our own sport, because there's 211 football countries around the world. In Australia, we have a small number of other sports, and I know in the past we've really benchmarked ourselves against other sports. I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn from the global game in our own sport, and there are lessons that we can apply in a specific sense to our code. If we can do that, I think what we do is we create a different product than a sort of normal Australian sport. And I think if we can differentiate ourselves from other Australian sports, I think it ultimately will help us. Specifically on your question about what that actually means, I think we do need to grow our base. We have a great base. This is correct. We have 1.8 million registered players, but I think there's a lot of growth opportunities there as well, because if you look at those numbers and you do it by gender, for example, only one-fifth of that 1.8 million are women and girls. Mm. So I see that as a high growth area to actually grow the total numbers. And I think the bigger base that we can create, that's our quantity, if you like. If we can invest more in our coaches and our pathways and our transfer system and get that right, then we can develop not just quantity but also quality. And I think that's the link then with our national teams, and also with our league as well, because ultimately the national teams and the league or leagues will be the beneficiaries, because you've got better players that are able to play, and then it goes back to the point I mentioned before. You have a better product, and a better product brings commercial revenues in, and that's the
cycle.
That's the cycle we want to create.
Yeah, and those players become part of that $10 billion
correct
annual industry that you're talking
correct
about
correct
as well. So how do you connect or keep connected or strengthen the connectivity between those clubs who are developing players outside the A-League system and also the A-League clubs, W-League clubs as well?
Mm-hmm. So I think if you look at clubs all around the world, South America, North America, Europe, wherever, Asia, there's really two different areas in my experience that motivate clubs and allow clubs to be connected all the way down the pyramid. One is through your competition structures, and the other is through your player movement system. What I would like to see is a domestic transfer system that's put in place. I think then that will connect your, let's say, your grassroots clubs, your aspiring clubs that fit in between a, or should fit in between, say, an NPL and an A-League, and your A-League clubs, because you will incentivize the clubs to develop players, and they'll be okay with losing the player because there's a distribution that comes down. I think at the moment that doesn't exist in the way I think it should, and this creates tension, because clubs at the base of the pyramid will say, well, you know, I don't like that the A-League clubs can take this player because I've spent X amount of years developing the player and now I've lost them, so why would I invest in the future? And I think this is a problem with the system. I think on the competition side, I'd like to see more football played. I think this is good at the moment. We have five national level games every weekend. I'd like to see more. And that can be done in different competition structures, whether it's the FFA Cup, the NPL. We could look at maybe restructuring the final competitions, the last 32, for example, in these competitions. Or could we create another competition where more football can be played? I think this helps connect those clubs from bottom to the top.
Yeah, exactly. Another consideration is the amount of overseas players playing here as well. I read with interest what the J-League did in the past is in the last 6 months they've said, okay, you can have as many foreigners as you want. Only five can play on match day, mm-hmm. whereas, say, Korea has still got the 3+1+1 rule. I think mm-hmm. they've got other leagues have different ways of doing it. We've got a five foreigner rule at the moment, maybe a guest player on top of it. But matters like that, which directly affect the development and those down the pyramid as well, as opposed to the professional clubs running their own race wanting a different thing. How does that happen now, given the fact that they're off running their own competition, you're in charge of the FFA? Have you got remit to go in and chime in and say it, or is it at board level? It's all very confusing for a simple guy like me.
Yeah, it's this is actually a very complex issue. It's one that when I was at FIFA, we would deal with FIFA would have their views representing the associations, and the clubs and the leagues who were represented by the European Club Association, the World League Forum, had different ideas. But really, I think it's a matter that needs to be negotiated between the two. The league will have very specific roster rules, so the rules around what the Europeans would call squad size limits. They would have rules around how many foreign players they can have in their roster. Mm. But I think the FFA needs to be part of that discussion, because ultimately the transfer system that includes the registration of players, and after all, when we talk about a squad, we're talking about how many and who you can register. I think it's a discussion the FFA need to be party to. And I think it's about finding a balance between the lifting of the quality of the competition, which is perfectly reasonable from a league standpoint, but also ensuring that we've got as many home-developed players, local players, Australian players, that can ultimately play for the national teams. I think it's about finding the right balance.
At a place like FIFA, I wouldn't imagine your commercial department, and even though everything that we've read about FIFA that's happened over the last 10 years, has too many worries about going to a sponsor and saying, do you want to come on board for our World Cup, for instance? It's a pretty good sell. FFA, how do you sell? How do you commercialise? How do you grow that particular pie or bake it properly and make sure it tastes nice going forward in the next couple of years?
Right. So I see the unbundling of the league as an opportunity for both the league and also the FFA. I think it gives the league a more specific focus on how to build the league product. And the opportunity for the FFA is to really build the brands, I think, of our national teams. At the moment, the Matildas and the Socceroos, their brands are good. They're strong. But how do we make those brands iconic? I think that's the challenge for us. I think we also need to look at how do we turn the big base that we have into revenues that can come in for potential partners. And that's probably more of a structural issue. The feedback that I've got from partners or potential partners is that they like the sound of the big base that we have, but it's hard to actually activate the brands on the ground because of all the different layers that we've got in our structures with the member feds and then down to the regional association. So I think the challenge will be how do we align FFA's commercial interest with the member federations and also the regional associations so we can get a bigger pie that we can distribute back to everyone. I think this is the challenge and the opportunity.
Your peace pie must be a good one. I don't know what in terms of bringing everyone together to try and do that. That's a big
call. It's a big job.
Call.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. But I think we need to be ambitious and we need to have the discussion at least, and we need to put facts and figures on the table. And I think that's the way we can shift the way we think about our commercial model.
Does it happen much around the world? I keep on coming back to around the world, given your extensive knowledge about how different countries run their race. And I'm just trying to get a different perspective on it. So in Australia, we've got all these state federations, member federations. Is that a usual practice in other parts of the world, in developed football countries?
In many of the Commonwealth countries, it is. So if you look at India, or you look at Canada, or you look at England, for example, there's a national body, and then they do have counties or state federations that exist under it. If you look at the 211 countries around the world, though, usually you have clubs that are members of your association, not your state federation. So it is unique. It's not the only country around the world that has this structure. But again, I think there's probably lessons that we can learn from these countries in terms of how they've dealt with these different layers and how they've been able to allow their partners to activate their brands despite the layers.
What's your mandate from the board? And I say that, like, have you got total control to do what you want with reference to going back to the board and being beholden to their overall structure and their overall principles about what they want from the game? Or are you having – how does it work? Like, each month you have to go and report to them and say, this is what I want to do, can I do it? Or have you pretty much got a bit more of a free rein than that?
No, the relation with the board is very good. So I report to the board in regular contact with our chair, and we're holding regular board meetings, so about every 6 weeks at the moment. Our relationship's very good. What we're discussing as an organisation is really starting with what I said at the very start of this podcast, which is the purpose. Mm. Why do we exist? Who are we? And then what is our vision for the organisation, and what are our values? This is where we are at the moment. And just to give you some insight into where these discussions are, is we're talking about unity. We're talking about the FFA being a connector of football institutions, of players, of community, commercial partners, government. That's what we see as our role. We're also talking about the FFA being a football-centric organisation. So how do we bring football back into the centre of every discussion we have? How do we ensure that we're acting in the interest of the game and not, say, just looking at the political and commercial aspects? This is the second point. And the third thing we're talking about is this local but global theme. How do we transform the organisation from one that is acting local and has acted local to one that can engage and be hardwired into the global football system? So that's where we are at the moment. Where we're going to move into in the coming weeks and months is starting to discuss under the umbrella of that purpose, vision, and values, what our priorities are as an organisation. But then we need to go out to our stakeholders and our football community and talk about what are the priorities for the game. And I think where we'll end up is we're going to end up with a strategy for the organisation. But what I hope to be able to do is agree with our stakeholders a whole-of-game manifesto where the different parts of the game understand what the game's priorities are and who is best positioned to actually deliver them.
What's your time frame on that? Because everyone wants everything yesterday in football in Australia. Don't know if you've noticed.
Well, I would say within the next 6 months, you know, I'd like to have some runs on the board in that space.
Yeah, it's not easy, is it? Because to enact change in something like a football organisation, which is so broad, can't be easy. But I mean, you've seen it at FIFA as well. I mean, is it more complex in Australian football as opposed to the governing body of football, full stop?
You mean FIFA?
Yeah.
It's different. When I started at FIFA, it was just before the big blow up in 2016. I'd been there for about a year. When the new president came into the organisation, Gianni Infantino, he identified very early that one of the key challenges for the organisation was its lack of engagement with the professional game. So he set up the professional football department, and I was lucky enough to lead that. And it was a very complex situation because you had the European clubs at the time who were talking about breaking away from the system. And when FIFA was weak, those discussions nearly materialised. Mm. You had the leagues that were getting organised and wanted to take on more regulatory control than what they had in the past. And you had the players who at the time filed a complaint at the European Commission for the transfer system. I think what FIFA did well, I think what we did well when I was there, was we really put in place a very robust and fair stakeholder management process where we brought the leagues, clubs and players into the system and allowed the participation of decision-making in a meaningful way through creating different structures. We created what was called the Football Stakeholders Committee. And there's a lot of change that's happened at FIFA as a consequence of bringing the stakeholders inside. So I think some of these lessons we could certainly apply to Australia. There are different challenges because they're global, but I think the essence and the lessons are very common, very similar, I would say.
So you've got two things to handle in your new role, which is domestically.
Yes.
So all those things that we've already discussed, mm-hmm. clubs, member feds, players, participation rates, and then internationally. So the flip side, so AFC, FIFA, everything that's going on around the world. Is that a time constraint on what you need to do domestically, or is it something that's easily manageable?
No, I think it's manageable. I think any of the top associations around the world now have the same challenge. I think what we need to do is we have to focus on getting the domestic game right, but not obviously disconnecting from the international element. And that can be solved by having, you know, someone who's focused on the international relations. Our chairman, Chris Nicu, is on the AFC Executive Committee, so a lot of his time will be spent with the AFC. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game, but I think we do need to get both right if we're going to be, I think, a top football association globally.
Yeah, because is that one challenge as well that we don't understand, is that if AFC wants something done, you guys have to go off to Kuala Lumpur to kind of meet with them. It takes you away from here. That's what one thing I kind of see, like mm-hmm. in the old administration, David Gallop, he was always having to go to Kuala Lumpur. There was one instance a couple of weeks ago when they changed the Champions League draw and Greg O'Rourke all of a sudden had to fly over there. Mm-hmm. Like if he didn't go over there, we wouldn't have got what we wanted with the draw, but that takes him away from the day-to-day running of the A-League. So that can't be a great thing for the A-League, but on the flip side, you've got to look after that particular area as well. You can't be in two places at once.
I think you're right, but because of the structure of the sport, there are a lot of decisions that happen at a regional at the AFC or a international at FIFA level that will impact the domestic game. I'll give you one example. We talk about not having as many players playing in the Premier League today as what we did 10, 15 years ago. I mean, this is a fact. But one major change to the FIFA transfer rules was in 2003 or 2004, where there was a ban that was put in place on the movement of players until the players turned 18. Mm. And in my view, that is actually one of the core reasons why we don't have as many players playing overseas at the moment, because the reality is players have to wait until they're 18 to move internationally. And players are more expensive when they get to 19, 20 years old. They're not put in to the top European clubs mm. who have the top training academies. So they probably lose those key areas of development. So I think if we're not at the table, and it's not just about being at the table, it's being able to drive the conversation. If we're not doing that, we may have decisions that ultimately have a negative impact on our domestic game anyway.
And that coincided, just from a personal perspective, looking at it, with the blow-up of the old Soccer Australia, NSL, A-League. Wasn't much attention paid to youth development in yes. those times from the A-League clubs, and then we get what we get a Correct. Bit later on. A couple of your favourites. So you played, you've stopped playing, you're not going to play on the weekend, you've got no time?
No, I always have time to play football. Yeah. I haven't played since I got back to Sydney, but I did play when I was in the UK and in Switzerland probably once a month. It's just pick-up level.
So no ALs on the weekends here where you have to, every third week or fourth week, you're on beers and you have to bring them along?
Not at this stage.
Not at this stage, fair enough. Who are your favourite players and teams? Are you allowed to have that within FIFA and now with the FFA? You're going to get accused of heinous bias if you name an A-League club.
No, I think I have to be honest. I'm a football fan as well, so absolutely. Yeah. I grew up playing in the late 80s and the 90s. And I was never a great player, but I was a player that players liked to have in the team because I'd do a lot of running and I'd try to make others
The water carrier.
Better.
Were you the water carrier?
Well, it's funny you say that because one of the players who I admired was Didier Deschamps, actually. Oh, yeah. I liked Carlos Dunga. So I liked those players that really could connect the team. They weren't the best player in the team. I think they were more than the water carrier.
They were.
but I think you could notice the players when they weren't on the pitch, and that's probably the kind of player I looked up to. At a local level, those players were players like Gary Phillips or David Clarkson. They're the kind of players that I really admired.
Two blokes who could still play as well, I reckon.
Yes.
Gary Phillips looks like, when he takes his shirt off, he looks like Ned Flanders.
Yes.
And Dave Clarkson is still, right. he could run a marathon a day. John Cosmina was a former coach as well.
Yes.
Hey?
Yes.
Caught up with Cosy since you've been back yet?
I haven't caught up with him since I've been back. I haven't caught up with him for many years, but he was, when I was going through the Queensland Academy of Sport, who was the youth team of the Brisbane Strikers when he was there, he did invite me to train with the Strikers as a youth team player for a couple of years. So I know Cosy. He never gave me a minute on the pitch, but that's a conversation for another day.
Oh, great. I'm going to remind Cosy of that.
Yeah, me too.
Everybody's come back to bite him. Come back to bite him. But your favourite teams, your favourite moments as well with football, what stands out in that regard? And what are the things that really grab you in terms of what makes you love football?
So there's not really any specific event, but it's rather a period. What I remember most vividly and probably my best memory was when I grew up. I grew up in Rockhampton, and it's a small town. And I played for a team called Bursica Bears, which was a local club. My father was the first team coach, and my mother was the team manager. Worked the canteen on weekends, and you know would clean the shirts. Mm. I was a mascot of the team, but it was a really important era because I really came to understand what community meant. All my friends, all my network, they all revolved around the club, and really the whole week revolved around the club. And I got to understand what it was like to win, what it felt like to win, the highs, but also what it felt like to lose. So I think for me, that was a really memorable period of my life, and it taught me many values that I've been able to take away from the sport and apply in a social and professional sense.
That community aspect as well, and it goes to the fans as well. We've had a few worries over the last few years with the fans. I'm sure you've been across that, about fans feeling a part of it. And if there's one major fact, and I've got nothing against the previous administration or David Gallop as a person, but I reckon they dropped the ball badly, really badly, in defence of their own fans and the active support and that. It just felt like the fans didn't have the support of the people leading the sport when it was copping a bit of heat from elsewhere. So I don't know, you can't predict the future, but I'm getting the vibe that you're a football guy who, if you reckon something's been unfairly reported or accused, you're going to stick up for the football community, be it fans, players, whatever.
I think we have to. I think we need to listen to our fans. I think we have to react to what's important to our fans. And ultimately, without fans, we don't have a sport. I think fans are probably our most important stakeholder, actually.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
How does that manifest itself then in the time that goes on? Back to that issue of being trying to stay connected with the professional game, going off with their own league.
I think I'd like to create some forums in the future where we're able to speak directly to the fans and really ask them what they like and what they don't like, where we can do better, where we're doing well. I think that direct engagement with the fans is a really crucial part of moving the sport forward. And I think there are examples now in other parts of the world where that relationship between a league and the fan, or a governing body and the fan, has been brought to life. And I'm hoping we can implement some of those lessons.
Is that the hardest thing? One of the hardest things about administration, especially for a sport like football, is that everyone who follows it loves it, and everyone who loves it has an opinion about it, because you don't love something without having an opinion about it. So taking all that in and kind of filter through the opinion that you agree with and the one that you don't, but still paying respect to someone who is obviously giving that from a position of actually loving the game, mm-hmm. that you're trying to balance all that up and push it in the direction that you want it to go, which might not be the direction of all that opinion that's coming.
Yeah, I think this is common. It was common when I was at FIFA, at AFC. It was common when I was at Manchester City as well. The reality is of the sport is it is a game of opinions. It's a game of interests. You've got people that will look at the same issue from different angles. I think the role of the governing body is to be able to listen and not only listen but to understand what messages are being given from the different angles that exist within the sport. I think the other thing that needs to be done is that the governing body needs to build trust with its stakeholders, with its partners, with the football community, because when it does come to a decision, you need to be able to articulate why the decision has been made. And sometimes it will go against sectional interest groups, but I think we can articulate why the decision is taken and why it's actually in the best of the game's interest, and generally those specific interests, they might not like the decision, but they'll understand why it's been taken. And I think that's something we need to do better in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that you've advertised for a director of communications and also another role as well. So you're trying to get the right people around you to help you with all of this.
That's right. So we're advertising for a head of communications. I think this is key, that building that consistent narrative in the community. I think this is something we need urgently. We're recruiting for a general manager of member federation relations so that we can have better alignment with the member federations for reasons we've discussed in this podcast. And we're also looking for a GM of national teams, which will effectively oversee our high performance and national team programs.
There you go. They're on seek.com.au. No, they're on the website, I think.
They're on the website. No.
James, thanks so much for giving us an idea about what's going on in your world at the moment. It's a very busy time, and I know you can't give too many answers because you're out there mainly listening still, but everything's been put in place. And as you say, within the next 6 months, we'll have a much clearer idea about where you want to push the sport. And I say this to all my guests, but I really, really mean it this time. Best of luck.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate it. It's great to be here. Cheers. Bye-bye.